I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Joining me now is the journalist and historian Stanley Carno. He was a longtime correspondent in Asia from the 1950s through to the 1970s for such organizations as Time, Life, the Saturday Evening Post, the London Observer, the Washington Post, and NBC News. His coverage of the Vietnam War led to his writing of Vietnam: A History, one of the definitive books on the war. It also led to a critically acclaimed and award-winning PBS series, Vietnam: A Television History. In an effort to learn more about Philippine history and politics, I had read another of Mr. Carno's books, In Our Image, America's Empire in the Philippines. It's easily one of the most comprehensive books on the Philippines and its relationship with the United States up to the late 1980s. The book received the Pulitzer Prize for History in 1990. It also inspired another PBS documentary that I saw recently that's just a great companion to the book. We'll talk to Mr. Carno now about his career, focusing on his time in the Philippines. We'll discuss some of the historical figures he had encountered in his years of journalism: Douglas MacArthur, Ferdinand and Imelda Marcos, Ninoy and Corazon Aquino, and others who figured so prominently in Philippine and American history. Stanley Carno served in the United States Armed Forces during the Second World War. He graduated from Harvard and attended the Sorbonne and the Institut d'Etudes Politiques de Paris. His other books include Mao and China from Revolution to Revolution and the memoir Paris in the 50s. He is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and the American Society of Historians. He joins me from his home just outside of Washington in Potomac, Maryland. I'm very pleased to welcome to the Plant Online program Stanley Carno. Mr. Carno, good morning.
Hello, how are you?
Very good, yourself?
I'm okay.
That's great. It's largely because of your book, In Our Image, that I wanted to speak to you about, but we'll also talk about your career. We'll touch on various aspects of your career. Now, the book, In Our Image, that won the Pulitzer Prize, and I actually saw an interview that you did with Brian Lamb on C-SPAN on the book, well, I guess when it came out. How did the book do in terms of sales? I know it was critically lauded.
It didn't do very well in terms of sales, and that was a bit of a disappointment to me. I would have thought that that a million, with a million Filipinos, maybe more than that, living in the United States, it would sell well among them. But for some reason, I don't think Filipinos are not in the United States are not particularly book buyers. Mm-hmm. I think it probably did better in the Philippines, where probably, to my knowledge, somebody pirated it, so you can get it for nothing or practically nothing.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm not going to moan about that. Writers don't write books to sell them. They write books to write the book, and if they sell them well, fine. If they don't sell them, it doesn't make any difference.
I was very
pleased to get a Pulitzer Prize for that.
Yeah.
But I didn't. First of all, I was very surprised to get a Pulitzer Prize, and I think I should have got one earlier for being a reporter, not for being a book writer. But at any rate, I had a marvelous time in the Philippines, and I had a good time writing the book too.
Yeah, and so the book has stood up, hasn't it? I mean, it goes up to the late '80s, You know, it's a book that, as I've told you previously, that I've been reading over the last year or so, that I've just, I mean, it's quite comprehensive. How long does a book like this take to write?
Well, probably a few years. I'm a slow writer. I'm a reporter by trade.
Mm-hmm.
I've been a news magazine or newspaper writer, a reporter for many years. Practically all my life I've been a journalist. I started out as a high school newspaper editor, then I was a college newspaper editor, and became a professional as early as 1950, when I was about 25 years old. And so what happens is you're a journalist, and you run around the world, as I did, and then you get to a certain stage, you realize that you're like a shortstop on a baseball team. Your legs begin to go out. So what you do is you save all the stuff that you've gathered as a reporter and then try to put it in between hard covers. And my books have been basically, I haven't written a lot of books, but they're basically, I used a lot of the material that I had gathered as a reporter. And that was quite satisfactory to be able to do that, just to be able to save all that material that I'd gathered over the years and then put it into a book form.
There was also a TV show that came out of this book.
Earlier had done a television series on the Vietnam War, and one of my television buddies, I'm not a television reporter, I'm a writer, but a guy who worked with me on a television series on Vietnam, a guy by the name of Drew Pearson, who spent a lot of time in Asia too, he had the idea of doing a short television series on the Philippines, and that was quite remarkable because we found some very odd people. I mean, we actually found a guy living in some place in the Middle West who had been in the American Army in the Philippines around the turn of the century. We found Howard Taft's daughter living in Pennsylvania. She was very old at this stage, but she remembered what it was like to be a little girl in the Philippines when Taft was the first civilian governor. So that was really quite thrilling to find these people, and these very early old people they're not great interviews because they're so old they don't remember many of these things. But then of course we spent a lot of time in the Philippines itself interviewing people, and I could go back and begin to tell you about what it was like to be in the Philippines.
Yeah. Well, when was it you first went there?
The reason I went to the Philippines is I was working in Europe, and then, as a matter of fact, I was working in Europe and North Africa, and suddenly I was working for Time magazine, and suddenly I got a cable, and they said, how about going to Asia? So next thing I know, I'm shot off to Hong Kong to be the chief correspondent for Asia for Time and Life magazines. So I had to not only cover China from a distance, we couldn't get in at that time, but I had all of Southeast Asia to cover. So the Philippines was part of the territory. So I started going there in 1959, shortly after I arrived in Hong Kong. And going to the Philippines was quite different from the rest of Southeast Asia. When I first went to the Philippines, I had a feeling like I was going home. You go to the Philippines, for one thing, everybody spoke English. English was actually the common language of the Philippines. They tried very hard to create a common language out of Tagalog and even call it Filipino. But in fact, you could go absolutely everywhere and people spoke English. And that derived from the fact that at the very early days of the American presence in the Philippines, the United States sent school teachers over. They were called Thomasites because they came on a ship called the Thomas, and they went off into the boondocks. The boondock being, by the way, a Filipino word, mm-hmm. And they started teaching. They did two things. They started teaching Filipino kids to brush their teeth and say their prayers, and they taught them English. So you could go almost anywhere in the Philippines, and people spoke English. The other thing about it is that we have this notion that they tried to create a national language, but in fact, Tagalog or Filipino was not a national language, because it was a language of Luzon, but then you got into the Visayas and the central Philippines, and people didn't speak that. They speak Cebuano. It's another language. In fact, there were probably eight different languages and countless numbers of local dialects spoken in the Philippines. And if you let me fast forward for a second, I mean, when I was many years later, when I was traveling around the Philippines with Cory Aquino, when she was running for president, mm-hmm. when she got down to places like Mindanao, she gives her lecture. She was doing her talking in English. You know, so many politicians spoke English. The other thing about the Philippines that was actually for a reporter was that you're an American reporter and you arrive in the Philippines and everybody welcomes you immediately. You can arrive on a Thursday night and then the next thing you know you're having breakfast with the president on Friday morning. Everybody, you know, being an American in the Philippines was a great plus. Filipinos, these days you have people looking back, and there's a lot of sort of in retrospect you hear people denouncing America, saying American rule in the Philippines was atrocious and so on. Actually, American rule in the Philippines was quite benign. At the beginning, there was the Filipino War, the war to conquer the Filipino nationalists, which was a very brutal war. It was like Vietnam without television. It was really horrible on both sides. Both the Americans were awful, and the Filipino nationalists were awful too. It was a very brutal war. But very early on, once the war was over, it was declared over in 1904. The American public was really kind of fed up with that war for what they learned about it. And the reporting on the war was extremely good in magazines like Harper's Magazine. You had marvelous stories about the war and what was going on. But as soon as, in 1904, President Theodore Roosevelt declared it over, and the next thing you know, we put in the first civilian governor. That was William Howard Taft, later president, later chairman of the chief justice of the United States. And very early on, we began to let the Filipinos begin to rule themselves. And we already, very early on, there was already a plan to give independence to Filipinos. We had some marvelously intelligent, phenomenally effective Filipino politicians, like Quezon, for example, Emmanuel Quezon.
Right.
You take his story, there's a city name for Quezon City, which is just outside of Manila. And Quezon is sent to the United States to become the kind of, to Washington, to be sort of the lobbyist for the Filipinos in Washington. And a lot of the legislation for the Philippines was legislation that Quezon wrote and lobbied Congress into, and he was a terrifically smart guy. He hung around Washington. He played poker with the politicians, and a lot of the early legislation came out of his presence. Now, there's one thing that American rule, I think, was very deficient in, and that was it was not very reformist. When you look back on the early days of the Philippines, the Philippines under the Spanish was almost a feudal society. Certain Filipino families had great pieces of land and so forth. And that continued during the American period. The United States found it easier to govern through these big landowning families. And there wasn't much reformism. There wasn't a land reform program, for example. But on the other hand, there wasn't much reformism in the United States either in those days. You don't begin to get land reform. And so the Philippines, I think one of it, the great weaknesses of the Philippines, and maybe that existed even to this day, is there was almost a kind of feudal society. And so many of the elites of the Philippines came from these family, landowning families. Cory Aquino, for example, her family owned a tremendous amount of land, and they had sugar plantations and so forth. By the way, her family was Chinese. There's a thing that's very important to note, and that is that many, many families in the Philippines, especially the dynamic families, were Chinese, or Chinese married into Filipino families, or a mixture of things. And so you'd have to, you know, you'd have to look at the Philippines, because you'd have to the gradation of the people. I mean, originally, people used to be proud, used to claim that they were Spanish origin, even if it wasn't true. Mm-hmm. Imelda Marcos, for example, used to claim, probably untrue, wasn't untrue, but she used to claim that one of her ancestors was a Spanish priest who had started the family out of wedlock, probably baloney, but anyway. And then you had these mixtures of Filipinos and Spanish and Filipinos and Chinese and so forth, till you got to the very bottom of the line, which are just Filipinos not in married. And some of the big big families, the rich families, would look down on the Filipinos, were and the ones who were not mixed in any way, and refer to them as Indios, you know, as if they were the pure Malays.
Right.
So you had all kinds of. And people came to the Philippines. There were people who came to the Philippines intermarried with Filipinos, intermarried with Chinese, and there was a great mixture of different kinds of people. The one thing that the Filipinos lacked was they didn't have a very strong sense of national identity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most countries in Asia had, you know, the Chinese or the Japanese or even the Vietnamese could always look back to some sort of emperor somewhere. You know, the emperor of China lived in Beijing, the emperor of Japan lived in Tokyo, Edo it was called, and so forth. What the Philippines was a collection of islands without any sense of cohesion. You had people speaking different languages, they have different origins. And what the big challenge for the Philippines, and I think it's a challenge to this day, is to try to work out some kind of a national identity. And I think the sense of nationalism in the Philippines is not very strong, and maybe not even still not very strong. One of the most interesting things about the Philippines is that I found, I mean, there are lots of fascinating things about the Philippines that I can go on talking about for hours, and in fact wrote a long book about it, but is Filipinos are travelers. I mean, the national export of the Philippines is people. And the money that the Filipinos send back to their families from abroad is probably the largest amount of money, that's the largest export.
Yeah.
The hospitals of America, for example, could not function without Filipino nurses. The oil fields of the Middle East could not function without Filipino technicians. Where I live, in a suburb, a very high-class, upper-class suburb of Washington, D.C., there are Filipino families that are very successful and very rich, and they send money back to their families. So there's a curious expatriation, if you want, of the Filipinos. I was hoping that a lot of these people who lived in America would buy my book, but for some reason, they're not book buyers.
Yeah.
But it doesn't make any difference whether they are or not. That's not the point.
Yeah.
But the point is that, you know, Filipinos have made tremendously contributions to the United States in so many of the things that they run. Now, one of the things that I've run into, mm-hmm. not recently, this is within recent years, is that you're beginning to get among some younger Filipinos this kind of looking back, a notion that that American rule in the Philippines was atrocious,
right.
It was filled with atrocities, and I've been on panels. You know, listening to some of these guys, especially a few Filipinos that come out of the academic community, you know, and it's very chic to talk about how we all suffered. You know, this mm-hmm. every ethnic group puts a big premium on how they suffered. And so, I remember being on one panel, and there was one guy insisting that Filipinos suffered under the yoke of white oppression, and I reminded him that. That Ho Chi Minh, as you know, was the leader of the Vietnamese war against France and then later the United States,
mm-hmm.
wrote a letter to Harry Truman in 1960, congratulating Harry Truman on Filipino rule, and he said in his letter, if the French had ruled Vietnam the way the United States had ruled the Philippines, we wouldn't have had any disagreement. So this guy listened to me when I said that, and he says, well, Ho Chi Minh didn't know anything about the Philippines. Well, it's true he didn't, but
yeah.
Whatever he did know was, and numbers of times when I spoke to Filipinos who had lived under the United States rule, by and large, it was their recollections were quite positive. I remember saying to a guy, an old man, I said, What was it like when the Americans were here? What do you remember best of all? He said, you know, when the Americans were here, we could get a fair trial. I mean, the court system.
Yeah.
You know, when the Americans were there, was typically a very good system. After independence, you got a lot of corruption in the court system, and to this day, for example, nobody knows. It's never been discovered who killed Nino Aquino, mm-hmm. or if they know, he has never gotten anywhere. So there are a lot of I remember, for example, I spent a long time at several interviews with Cardinal Sin.
Right.
Odd name for a cardinal, but anyway. And talking about what it was like to growing up under the Americans, and he would interrupt his conversations to sing these little school songs that he learned when he was going to school, you know, with American school teachers, you know, and so a lot of Filipinos had these memories, and one of the things that was really quite fascinating when you traveled outside of Manila and you went into the towns. They would always have, on their Saints' Day, they would celebrate the Saints' Day. What would happen would be that there'd be a parade, and they would carry out a big plaster statue of the saint that they're celebrating, and then the high school band would come along, and they played John Philip Sousa marches. They all played these American marches. And sometimes it was quite improbable. For example, there was a march that the American soldiers early on used to sing. It's called "The Monkeys Have No Tails in Zamboanga." Well, that became a song that they it's an atrocious song, mm-hmm. But that was a song. One of the things the bands would play. very often when the Filipino bands, incidentally, Filipinos are absolutely marvelous musicians, terrific right. musicians, and they would meet in the evening in Manila. They'd meet in Luneta, which is the main park of Manila, and they have these concerts, and they play these things to the point where Filipinos used to think that the national anthem of the Philippines was, there'll be a hot time in the old town tonight, that they play these American songs. And so to go back to what I said in my early days, one of my early impressions was like it was going home again.
Yeah.
Everybody spoke English. The newspapers were, there were English language newspapers that were set up, and in the early days, American editors came and taught the Filipinos how to run the newspapers. And the newspapers began to remind you of Chicago, and the newspapers would always have these banner headlines. I remember a common one was using this kind of American slang. You know, they'd say, the headline would say, "City Dads Bear Fraud," which means that the city and municipality has gone and found some fraud among politicians, which was quite common. And so you had newspaper columnists, and a lot of them learned a lot of their trade from American newspaper editors who came along. And as a reporter myself, I got to know many of these columnists, and one of the things to do in Manila when you went there was to go over every morning to a place called the Country Bake Shop, where everybody's assembled, all the reporters and columnists assembled, and exchanged gossip and whatnot. And so one of the things you felt in the Philippines, you felt very much at home.
Yeah, yeah.
As an American. Other parts of the of Southeast Asia, sometimes you would encounter problems because you're American. One of the most fascinating little anecdotes I remember was when the president of the Philippines was Mag Saysay,
mm-hmm.
And he was trying to deal with the Hook rebels. That was a rebel movement. And he had an American advisor with him, Colonel Lansdale, who's immortalized in a book called Ugly American. And he'd always stand up on the platform, and he had Colonel Lansdale standing next to him. And someone said to him once, "Don't you think that's very bad for your image to have an American standing next to you?" And actually, so I said, "No, just the contrary. The Filipinos love it, just to have an American, to think that's American." And one thing that, again, is very hard to explain to audiences, to American audiences who don't know anything about it, is that one of the great heroes of the Philippines was General MacArthur.
Right.
For example, I remember several years ago, a group of young Filipinos came to Washington, and I had lunch with them, and they were kind of leftish, if you want to call it that. Or that's not a fair. Anyway, so I said, "So what are you doing after you leave Washington?" And they said, "Oh, we're going up to Norfolk, Virginia, to pay our respects at the tomb of General MacArthur."
Mm-hmm.
General MacArthur could have run for king of the Philippines and got elected.
Did you travel with MacArthur when he went back in 1961?
Yeah, I'm going to tell you that because, one of the famous moments in MacArthur's career was that he, during the war, he landed at Leyte in the south,
mm-hmm.
and he splashed ashore, and he was furious because the LST didn't get in close enough, and so he wet his pants and so forth. He was furious. He had that angry expression on his face, and he started fuming about that, and someone said to him, "Hey, don't be angry. You look great when you have that expression because it shows you're filled with determination."
Yeah, yeah.
So he did another. He did a remake of that landing up in Lingayen Gulf, and that's where I covered him. He landed there on his. He made a trip back to the Philippines in 1960-61, and I went up to Lingayen Gulf with a life photographer called Carl Maidans, who had spent a long time in the Philippines, had been in the Philippines, was put in a camp during the Japanese occupation, and was a great friend of MacArthur's. So we went up there, and MacArthur, there he was. He splashed ashore deliberately this time, so he could get himself photographed. And then we went from the Lingayen Gulf, which is about halfway up in northern part of Luzon, and we went in a motorcade down through Luzon to Manila. And every time he stopped, with millions of people came out to cheer him as he came down. And he was a tremendous ego, of course, and he delighted in this great crowds of coming down. He would stop at the cemeteries. A lot of American soldiers were killed in the Battle of Luzon, by the way. And Luzon is covered with American military cemeteries. And then we got into Manila in a kind of motorcade, and mobs of people were out there. They could have elected MacArthur king of the Philippines. And we ended up at the Manila Hotel, that beautiful hotel, where he used to stay when he was living in the Philippines, and there's a MacArthur suite. And he came out on the balcony with his wife, and there were great crowds of people standing below cheering him, that he was standing there with his wife, and they started singing "Let Me Call You Sweetheart." I mean, it's a corny old American song. So there we were. MacArthur was the sort of the great, you know, a lot of people in America who thought he was very dangerous and worried that he might run for president, and President Roosevelt thought he was the most dangerous man in America. But the Filipinos loved him. The other thing about the Philippines that again, part of this whole kind of, if you want to call it, love affair with the United States is everything that had to be, and everything that you bought, if you were, especially if you were upper class family, had to be imported from the United States. Let me give you an example. Mm-hmm. Many times I'd go to dinner at the Malacañang Palace, that's the presidential palace.
Right.
I get invited to that. And at dessert, the dessert would be Libby's canned fruit salad made in America, which they would somehow get from the American bases, the PXs at the American bases. Now, the Philippines has the most marvelous collection of tropical fruit of any place I know in the world. And when I stayed at the Manila Hotel with my wife, we used to go out to the markets to buy all these marvelous things, these mangoes and papayas and all these marvelous... But for the upper-class Filipinos, they were considered to be sort of native fruits. You didn't eat those things. You wanted to eat imported fruit salad. For example, cigarettes. All the brands, American brands of cigarettes, were made under license in the Philippines. But if you were very chic, what you wanted to do was smoke Marlboro cigarettes made in the United States, which again, people would get from the black market from the American bases. So there was this whole notion that anything that's American is better. And one of the great things would be to go to the United States and go to school. And I remember I spent a lot of time with a lovely woman by the time I got to her. She was quite old. But she had been exported to the United States. They had this program of fellowships, of scholarships for deserving Filipinos would go to the United States. And many of them would go to colleges. And she used to tell me stories about how she ended up in some dinky little college in Missouri or someplace, and she said when I came, everyone thought I was going to appear in a grass skirt, you know, from the Philippines. Mm-hmm. But she spoke English all the time, And she used a phrase to me, "I make love in English," she said, to my husband, who was a Filipino officer and spoke English too. And as you know, one of the great things for a Filipino officer was to go to West Point, and you did, in fact did have one of the presidents, Ramos, was a
right.
West Point graduate. So there was a lot of that sort of thing. Now, one of the things that was particularly gratifying to me, and one of the things that was so marvelous in my experience, was that Ninoy Aquino, who was the main opposition to Marcos,
mm-hmm.
Was a very close friend of mine. He adopted reporters. He himself had been a reporter for the Manila Times. He was a marvelously funny, smart, sassy kind of guy. He used to call himself Dennis the Menace. He went around tweaking everybody's nose. He knew every. When I started going there, he was he was a senator, and we got to know him. I got to know him quite well. And he'd take me out in his limo, and he knew every nightclub and every whorehouse in Manila. And Marcos put him in jail, which I think was a big mistake in Marcos's. And it's funny because Marcos basically admired him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had been members of the same fraternity in college. And but Marcos feared him. Marcos feared that Aquino was going to oust him, and Aquino would have ousted him if he hadn't been put in jail. There's a myth that Marcos put him in jail after clearing it with Nixon, which is not true. Absolutely untrue. The American ambassador in the Philippines, Byrod, his name was horrified when Aquino was put in jail because he was afraid that it would turn into some kind of a big rebellion against Marcos. At any rate, so Ninoy did go to jail, and then we had a funny, odd kind of experience. In 1970, this is before Ninoy was in jail.
Mm-hmm.
I was a fellow at the Kennedy School at Harvard, and I knew Ninoy very well. And I said to them I said, "How about having Ninoy Aquino come over here and lecture?" So they said, "Fine, you arrange it," and I did.
Mm-hmm.
So Ninoy came and he lectured at Harvard, and I was a little concerned about his lecturing to a bunch of academics because Ninoy is kind of a rough-and-tumble guy. He isn't kind of the kind of guy normally addressed to academics.
Yeah.
But he was boffo. He went over marvelously well. So then when he went to jail, my wife had this idea. She said, "Why don't you see if you can't get the Kennedy School to invite him to come back and give another lecture? He's in jail, but send a message to Marcos and say, we'd like to have Ninoy come back and give another lecture." So next thing you know, the Kennedy School sent this thing to Marcos saying, "We'd like to have Ninoy Aquino come back and give another." And this had a peculiar effect on Marcos. First of all, Marcos saw this as a way of getting Ninoy out of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing, Marcos was very impressed by the fact that Harvard was inviting a Filipino to come to the United States. Harvard was inviting a Filipino to go to Harvard, so he let him out of jail on that grant. And Harvard and Ninoy and Corey and the kids and everybody, they moved to Roxbury, Massachusetts, just outside of Cambridge. And so Ninoy was at Harvard. He was a fellow at Harvard, and I used to go and see him because I was a graduate and alumnus of that school. And then he made this great mistake of deciding to go back to the Philippines, and that's where he got killed. And to this day, I don't really know, and I don't think anybody does, or if they do, I haven't seen any evidence that they've made it public.
Yeah.
But he was a great man. He was a marvelous guy. Yeah. He really was, and would have made a great president.
What do you make of his son now? He's the president. Did you know Noynoy Aquino?
Well, I only knew him as a kid because, you know, I used to see them, Ninoy and Corey and the kids. In fact, they used to come over to Hong Kong sometimes and have dinner with us at my house in Hong Kong. We were really like, you know, it was sort of funny because you get these relations with guys like Ninoy. You become kind of almost sort of family relations. And Ninoy was not exactly a saint by any means. I remember one time he came to Washington and I was driving around with him and Corey and so forth, and I said something about something or other, I can't remember what, but I didn't realize that he had a girlfriend in Washington.
Uh-huh.
He had girlfriends everywhere. And the other thing about Ninoy was really very funny. Ninoy used to tell people that he belonged to he was in the CIA, which was not true. But he thought that that was good for him because so many Filipinos admired people. They thought if you were in the CIA, you really had some great power.
Right.
So he would go around saying that he was in the CIA. And I once asked the CIA station chief in Manila, I said, is it possible that Ninoy is in the CIA? And this guy laughed and said, Ninoy in the CIA? He's such a blabbermouth, we could possibly have him in the CIA.
So. The Marcoses, I wanted to ask you about them. Did you get to know them as well as you did the Aquinos?
You get to know everybody. As I say, when you go there, you know, going to see Imelda, going to see Marcos was routine. I mean, they'd have you over, and you gotta, sometimes you go and listen to Marcos, and he'd go on babbling about a lot of stuff, which was probably not true. He'd tell you these stories about how he was in a guerrilla movement against the Japanese, which was not true. And one of the oddest things that could happen to you is getting invited to dinner by Imelda. I remember one evening I was out having dinner with some friends of mine in some restaurant in Manila. And the waiter called me over to the telephone. He said, call me. He says, there's a telephone message for you. So I go to the telephone, and there's somebody saying, this is so-and-so's, one of Imelda's courtiers.
Mm-hmm.
She said, the first lady would like to have you to dinner. She's sitting at the dining room at the Manila Hotel. Can you come there immediately? And we'll send a car for you. So I go back to my friends. And I said, look, I hate to do this, but, you know, I'm a reporter, and I want to see what this is all about. So the car comes for me, and I go back to the Manila Hotel dining room. And there she is, surrounded by all her buddies, her courtiers, and so forth. And one thing I have to hand it to Imelda, she was a great singer.
Mm-hmm.
Imelda knew every Broadway hit tune you can imagine. Every Gershwin tune, every Jerome Kern tune, every Irving Berlin tune, and nothing turned her on more than to sit over dinner and start singing. And so here you are, and it's already about 10 o'clock at night, and the next thing I know, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. And I'm still sitting there, and she's still singing, and she's singing these songs. She's belting out these songs, which she was terrific at, and she sort of invent these stories, like when she was a little girl, as she told me,
mm-hmm.
You know, she grew up in Cebu in the central Philippines in the Visayas. And when Marcos came, when MacArthur came into that area, she says, next thing I know, he put me in his car and I used to sing these songs to him. It was probably a lot of baloney, but that's beside the point.
Yeah.
So she really enjoyed that, and And I remember one time we're sitting at one of these dinners, it was going on forever, and I went to the men's room with one of her buddies, and I said, how long does this last? And he said, this could go on till early in the morning. She never sleeps.
Yeah.
So there she was, and she did the oddest kinds of things. I mean, she'd have for example, there was one stage where She had a porno film festival, of all things, in Manila. And one time we were going, I was with her, and she got me to go in her limo, and the next thing you know, we're weaving through this terrible traffic in Manila, and she's got these motorcycles ahead of her, guiding her limo around wherever she was going. And she's sitting in the back with me, and she says, "This is what power is all about. You see this? You get right through the traffic with these." So there she was, and all these great stories about her shoes I think the Filipinos deserve something better. And Marcos was really, I'll tell you, when Marcos first came into office, Marcos was a very smart guy. People said, "What do you think of Marcos?" And I said, "Well, Marcos is like wine. It depends on the year. There were the good years and there were bad years. And the early Marcos years, they were very good. Wines are very good sometimes when they're in their early years. This notion about wines have to be aged is a lot of baloney. It's some wines are very good because the grapes are very good."
Mm-hmm.
So in the early days, he was a smart guy. He was a smart guy. But he began, he began to be more and more corrupt, if you want to use the word corruption. He started inventing these stories about his role during the war, and so forth. And he had a lot of support in Washington because these stories about being anti-Japanese, a lot of people in Washington bought these stories, thought they were true. They were not true. People did research and discovered that he was not in any kind of a guerrilla movement.
Or the most decorated soldier.
These are the stories that he used to put out and so forth. But he was basically, he was an intelligent guy. And it's too bad because the Filipinos had some marvelously talented people. Mac Saysay, of course, was sort of in the post-war period, was a first-rate politician, and as I mentioned, the earlier ones like Quezon and so forth. So it's hard to tell. I mean, I don't want to pass judgment, but it was really marvelous about to go back again because my book is called In Our Image. It's a book about the American experience of the Philippines. It's not a history of the Philippines. I think maybe the history of the Philippines has yet to be written by a Filipino. And sometimes there are books. They tend to be very slanted politically, depending on the author.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not what I was writing about. What I was writing about was that particular, as I say, the title makes it clear that it's the Filipinos sort of inventing themselves in the American image or reinventing themselves in the American image. And I have talked numerously, very often, a lot of friends of mine were ambassadors, American ambassadors to the Philippines. And they always had a great time. I had a marvelous time there. And sometimes I would go out around the countryside. One of the most fascinating things about the Philippines were the number of Filipinos who served in the American Armed Forces during the Second World War. And a lot of them, unfortunately, are not getting the recognition that they deserved. But you could go into some little town in the middle of the Philippines and find an American Legion post, and you go in there, and there are a bunch of guys sitting around playing poker or mahjong or whatever, and they're getting what they're getting some kind of payment for having served in the American Armed Forces. Now, in my day, $10,000 a year was quite a bit of money. So these guys would sit around in these places, and they'd hang out there playing cards, smoking cigars. And the Veterans Administration office in Manila, in the American Embassy, was the most active office in any American embassy in the world. You had all these guys who had served the American Armed Forces receiving these pensions, and then on American holidays, these guys would go out and march, and then play these John Philip Sousa bands would play, the high school bands would play. So there was always this kind of affinity for the United States. It was a very close affinity for Americans. And as again, one of those things that when you go there, you feel comfortable.
Yeah.
And contrast to a lot of other parts of Southeast Asia.
Mr. Karnow, Stanley, it's been such a great pleasure and a privilege to have you on the program. And,
well, I must thank you for letting me babble like that.
It's a lesson here for I think a lot of people about journalism, about history. I appreciate your time today, and be well.
Okay, take care of yourself.
Stanley Karnow joined me on the line from his home in Potomac, Maryland, in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunton.